They are the last to freely move livestock across the great American landscape. But since their livestock is not cattle, perhaps we should find another name for them, like B-boys and B-girls.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 571st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Cairns who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with Dave Michaels on the boards and producers Carol Stafford and Parmley Taff. Folks, here's a fact. One out of every three bites of food that you and I eat is made possible by bees. And so bee boys and bee girls are most always on the move from Mississippi to Iowa to pollinate apple and pear trees, strawberries and raspberries, on to the Red River Valley in North Dakota for sunflowers, and then to the bighorn country of Wyoming for alfalfa, over to Washington State for snowberry, apple, and cherry, and then down to Oregon for clover, thistleberry, cherry, and vetch, from Florida to California, South Carolina to New Jersey, Pennsylvania to Maryland, to West Virginia and Delaware. Yes, folks, bee boys and bee girls are on the move along America's food chain. Today, you and I are going to join them. So grab a cup of coffee, pull up a chair, and fasten your seatbelt as we make a run for the honey. Here to help us lead the way, we have Douglas Wynot, who is the author of Following the Bloom and also a professor of creative writing at Emerson College in New Hampshire. Welcome aboard, Doug.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good. We were chatting briefly about your efforts in putting together Following the Bloom. 10 years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was just about 10 years.
10 years? And but it was even more than that, too, because you had a lot of interest in bees to start.
I did, yeah. I had an uncle who had them when I was a kid, and I used to stand near the hive and observe what I could, and I just had a fascination with insects anyway, flying insects. I like bees and wasps and like to observe them jigging around, and I used to capture them and put them in jars, not a nice thing to do, and look at them under microscopes and that sort of thing. And one day, I was walking home, and I passed by a field and saw a beehive down in the field. It was late in the day, and the bees were kind of streaming in from wherever they were foraging, the fields by the Connecticut River, back to their hive. And because of the angle of the sun, it was a low, late day sunlight, and it was kind of illuminating them, lighting them up. So there were these little points of light that were kind of drifting back over that field to the hive, and I was just kind of mesmerized by it. I stood there. My dog took off. He went home. I went down to the hive and got real close to it, kind of a little bit behind it, and just got down, crouched down, and watched him coming in, and that kind of got me started. I went, my neighbor owned the hive, and I went to him and started asking questions, and eventually got my own, and then began to write about it.
And there you go.
Yeah.
Take us back in history and give us kind of a thumbnail of the of beekeeping, because it's not something that we started recently. It's something we've been doing forever, almost, correct?
Yeah. I would say forever. Pretty much we've been, of course, seeking out honey, and that goes way back into antiquity, just to the, the idea of going up to a beehive and reaching in and grabbing comb. And the Egyptians had honey. Of course, the ancient societies all had it, but I do remember that the pharaohs were embalmed in honey. And the first settlers that came over to New England, where I live, they brought hives over, and they kept them in those straw skeps, those straw domes that you see pictured. And that style of beekeeping involved killing the bees at the end of the year in some of the hives, and then taking the comb out and pressing it. And then in the 19th century, there were more hives were, they were box hives. The bees were kept in boxes, and the same sort of technique was used of killing bees off and taking the honey. But during the mid-19th century, the movable frame hive was developed in which they were sort of like file drawers that were put into the hive. And the key to doing that was the discovery of bee space, which was...
Bee space,
which is a kind of a neat term. The discovery of that was credited to Lorenzo Langstroth, who discovered that bees would respect a certain space. If you put a hive frame in a hive and it was 3/8 of an inch away from the hive body wall, the bees wouldn't fill it up with wax. They'd leave that space open. So that allowed them to put movable frames, or just they look like picture frames with wax in the middle,
mm-hmm.
into the hive, and then pull them out and just take the honey out by extraction, meaning spin it around by centrifugal force, spin it up by centrifugal force, and then put that frame back in the hive for the bees to refill the comb.
So you didn't have to kill the bees.
You didn't have to kill the bees, and you could manage them and move them and continue to use the hive and keep a high colony count and also get a much, much higher production. So that was a revolution in beekeeping and commercial beekeeping.
Take us through the sociology of a hive.
Well, there are... it goes way back to the evolution of insect society.
You had a great word for it, but what was that?
The angiosperm explosion?
Angiosperm explosion, exactly.
Yeah, that was from a book called, I saw that term in a book called Bumblebee Economics by Bernd Heinrich. It was a book I really got a lot of information from. That concept was, sort of illuminating to the imagination. It was the idea that 100 million years ago, over a period of 20 million years, the development of enclosed seeds was made. And the flowering plants that produce seeds, and those plants function by means of pollination. So as these plants began to arise, and fruits and vegetables and grasses developed in which flowers were producing pollen that was transferred from one flower to another in order to create cross-pollination and make seeds and fruits, insects arose, that insect societies arose. Bees species were developed that specialized on eating pollen. In the honeybee society, pollen is the protein source. And pollen is gathered, when you see honeybees, you see those, their back legs have those little grains of pollen held in by pollen baskets. They transport those pellets of pollen back to the hive and store them just like they store nectar, which is made into honey. So as part of this evolutionary process, the flowers or the plant was producing pollen for the bees, but also producing nectar. And I'll take that back. The plant was producing pollen to transfer genetic material to another plant, and it happened to be in the form of a protein housed in a protein. But the plant was producing nectar as a lure to the bees to come to the flowers. So the nectar, in the economic system of the flower...
was a payday.
That was the payday, right. The nectar was the payday. So... they induced the insects to come to their plant by nectar, and as a result, the bees were gathering but also transporting pollen to other flowers. And they did this just by the pollen would stick to the hairs on their bodies, and they would just move them as like dust from plant to plant. And as they did this, pollination was achieved.
Mm-hmm.
So a reproduction was a result of the system of payoff of nectar. the bees developed, the honeybees developed the abilities and evolved in such a way so as to transform nectar through the addition of salival compounds that they produced into honey. And they did that by adding things to it, but also evaporating it. They took the nectar back to the warm hive and, you know, dumped it into these tubs of honeycomb and then began fanning air currents through the hive. If you look it up...
And we're going to have to take a quick break right now, Doug, but when we get back, I want to ask about the social structure and the function of each of those social structures within the hive.
Sure.
Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Doug Wynot. We're talking about following the bloom across America with migratory beekeepers. Right back. We're back, folks. Welcome aboard. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're following the bloom with Doug Wynot across America with migratory beekeepers. We talk a little bit about the sociology of a hive and the various functions within that social structure. I guess a good place to start, Doug, would be with the queen.
Yeah, the queen is at the center of the hive. She's a fertile female that lays eggs. There's one of them in every hive, and she's capable of laying up to, 1,000 or more eggs per day, and that's what her job is. She, during the busy season, when everything is, the flowers are producing, she is creating new populations for the hive, a new population by depositing a single egg in each cell, cell in the honeycomb, and those eggs hatch in 2 or 3 days and then are nursed along by nurse bees who produce royal jelly and other compounds.
What is royal jelly?
Royal jelly is a special compound that the bee produces that results in the formation of a queen bee, results in a bee that is able to produce eggs.
Mm-hmm.
It's given to all bees for 2 or 3 days, but it's given to queen bees for a longer period, 10, 12 days or more, and that creates this development of the queen, which has a different body than the worker bees, the normal worker bees. Those are the bees we see on the flowers in the field
right.
Coming into the hive. So all of the worker bees are females, but only the queen is a fertile female. So, and that's the result of the feeding of the royal jelly, which, you know, some people know as a kind of a supplement or food that we eat. It's gathered and it's supposed to have very beneficial properties, but the queen is the one, the bee that is at the center of the hive. And
so you have the queen, and then you have the worker bee, and what are the drones?
The drones are the other males, the male bees, and they are there for breeding. Really,
mm-hmm.
they mate with the queen, and they do nothing else. They can't sting. They don't work. They're fed by the workers. They just basically lay around the hive and go out.
I like to have that job.
Yeah.
You also talked about colony morale.
Yeah,
you made reference to the fact that the drones might be responsible for the morale of the colony.
Yeah, that's what that's what I understand to be the case. That with drones, the hive is the healthy functioning colony and morale is improved and everything is as it should be, but
mm-hmm.
without drones the hive is in a state of confusion, I guess.
Right.
You might say.
And you also made mention of the various functions, I think, of worker bees. Some of them are scouts,
yeah.
Some of them are followers,
mm-hmm.
some of them are, how does that work?
Well, during the season the newly hatched bee spends 3 weeks in the hive doing various duties, and then three weeks or maybe more outside gathering nectar and pollen. So they have a life of about 6 weeks in the real busy part of the season. Now, after the bee hatches, it comes out and it spends a couple of days kind of acclimating itself, but it begins to become a cleaner, and they become nurse bees, and they become sometimes guard bees, they become wax builders. But they basically proceed through a series of duties according to their age.
Oh. So they don't just take one job and they're there forever. They move through
different jobs, and then some of them gather the nectar from the foragers as they come in and transport it into the cells. And then as they're doing that, the nectar goes into their honey stomachs, and some of these compounds are added to it. So there's, you know, they're passing the stuff along as the nectar is transformed into honey. So that's another job too. And some are feeding royal jelly to the newly hatched larva, and then some become guard bees. Now you'll see sometimes if you are watching, observing a beehive, and you look at the entrance, you'll see bees that are just kind of there. They're sort of hunched down like, you know, football players or something, and they're looking, they're watching, they're inspecting, they're smelling. You know, honeybees are able to smell with their antenna,
right?
And they're checking out bees that might be intruders. I've heard that if a bee comes in with nectar, they won't stop it. But if a bumblebee tries to get in, or a wasp, they're all over it. Or if you try to reach in the hive with your hand or do something like
right.
that, they're after you. And there's a certain percentage of bees that do that. That varies by race. One of the real differences between the European bees that have been transported to this country to become commercial bees, or in commercial beehives, or just honey-producing hives, one of the differences between them and the Africanized bee that became the killer bee was the number of bees that become guard bees, and they become aggressive guard bees. And I say the Italian bee is the bee that became the commercial bee, because they're
right.
productive. You know, you might get 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bees coming after you if you go up and rap on the hive or something like that, unless they've been fooled around with a lot. But in an Africanized hive, that number gets up into the hundreds.
So the whole colony comes after you.
Yeah, then. a big percentage, but say 600 or 800 bees come after you to sting you. They're going to, persuade you to flee. And that's how they've evolved to survive.
So let's go to the business of beekeeping. Yeah. And is it really true that 1 out of 3 bites of food we eat are made possible by bees?
That's what I don't know about 1 or 3 bites, but it's a $20 billion agricultural industry that depends upon pollination.
Right.
Part of that includes the pollination of alfalfa, which produces forage crops for alfalfa seed, which produces forage crops for dairy. So part of that has been factored in to that figure, but fruits and vegetables are pollinated by honeybees. So there's kind of a chain of foods that we depend on that are that require pollination. And now that require commercial pollination.
And there's a big difference there, too. You, in following the bloom, you make mention of the fact that there are approximately 212,000 beekeepers in the United States with 4 million hives.
Mm-hmm.
But 1% of those, so 2,000 professionals, have 2 million hives. So 1% of the beekeepers owns 50% of the hives.
Yeah, and that number has increased. Because of the increase in mites and pests, and also viruses, and those numbers have changed. It's very difficult now, especially in cold climates, to overwinter bees because of varroa mites and tracheal mites, and the number of hobbyist beekeepers has diminished over the years, past couple of decades, and that number is no longer 50%. That's up around the end of the 70s, up to 80%.
So to keep the bees over the winter, then you have to move them down to Florida where it's warm.
Well, that's what some of the migratory beekeepers do, but it's harder for hobbyist beekeepers to keep hives. For the hives to survive because of the mites. Where I am, 2 years, if you don't do something, if you don't treat, and it's becoming harder to treat for tracheal mites and varroa mites, you'll start a hive up and it'll become very strong and produce a honey crop. But after a couple of years, the hive won't survive, won't make it through the winter or the off season. And that's happened to me. I lost 3 hives a couple of years ago, and it's happened to a lot of hobbyist beekeepers who I've talked to.
Yeah,
we've become much more dependent on commercial beekeeping, much more.
Okay, folks, you're tuning into The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for the hour with Douglas Why Not, following the bloom across America with the migratory beekeepers. And 1 in 3 bites we eat, or said to, or attributed at least, to be for benefit of the bees. And so that's the subject today, right back. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're following the bloom with Douglas Why Not. We're tracking the course of beekeepers and bees across the country. And Doug wrote a real fascinating story of following migratory beekeepers across the United States. So we're going to be picking that up right now and talking a little bit about the experience and how that whole industry works and how much of our food is is based on those pollinators. Doug, is it possible to go through the required pollination without these industrial beekeepers?
No, it's not. And in California, in the almond industry, you have the best case of the need for commercial beekeepers. Almonds require intensive pollination. I don't have the figures, unfortunately, right at the top of my head, but almond growers will soon, because of the increase of orchards, it's a successful industry. California produces basically the entire world almond crop. They require, for pollination, the number is approaching all of the beehives in this country.
Wow.
They are now beginning to, and I think last year was the first time, import bees from
Florida.
Foreign countries.
Oh, really? From foreign countries?
New Zealand and Australia. No, not just Florida. It's basically all commercial beekeepers in this country now move their hives into almond groves. For one thing, the rental fee has been raised high enough to induce them to
sure.
do that.
Otherwise, they wouldn't come, right?
They wouldn't come.
Not enough nectar, no beekeeper will show up, right?
It's the same system, yeah. I mean, the beekeeper I know so well, he's the major character of my book, is based in New England and now in New York State, too. He transports his hives to California for almond pollination.
Wow.
And he was the first one to make the cross-country trip from, the east to the west in order to do that. It's up. I just had this figure a few weeks ago, but it's up in the mid-100, 100-plus area, $120, $30, $40 per hive to bring your hive into almonds. That's how necessary it is for California almond growers to have bees.
So no bees, no almonds.
No bees, no almonds.
Simple as that. And almonds are so valuable now that they're able to suck the entire population of honeybees from throughout the entire country into California.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the equivalent of that, right? And they're now bringing bees in from New Zealand and Australia. So, that's one case, but, apples.
So do they actually fly they must fly the bees, right?
No, they truck them.
I mean from New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
I had to have that image of bees flying in an airplane from New Zealand to California.
Yeah, a cargo airplane coming into California and then being transported by truck from the airport to the almond grove. That's where we are now. Now, it used to be they would, in California, they'd come in by train and then they'd move by horse and wagon, out to wherever it was they're going. Probably not almonds then, but they used to transport them by train. And then, there were growers and beekeepers in California who would put hives in the back of Model A trucks and go out to the, the agricultural areas, wherever they needed to go, and do it that way. Then it evolved to semi-loads of bees, 440 hives on a truck, netted down, traveling on the interstates. And now, for almond growers anyway, it's becoming this flight thing.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And introduce us to your Andy Card.
Well, Andy is someone who sort of grew up in the beekeeping business. His father was a businessman who started beekeeping business in Massachusetts, kind of as a hobby, but he soon got to the point where he was one of the bigger beekeepers with several hundred up to 1,000 hives, and he was renting them out to apple growers right in the area where he lived. Started with apple growers and going out at night when the bees were in the hives and delivering hives to the apple orchards.
So beekeepers...
And getting a fee, $5 or $10 for a fee.
And they're up to $120. In,
right.
Wow. Now, bees work during the day, but beekeepers work at night.
Well, they work at night because that's when you can go to a hive and pick it up, knowing that the bees will be there. The bees return to the hive at dusk, basically, at the end of the day.
Right.
And that's when you can pick them up. So they keep their hives on pallets, that are used with forklifts, and they'll strap them, fasten them down.
You made mention of bobcats.
Yeah, bobcats.
And how bobcats changed the world of beekeeping.
It's true. Yeah, they did. Those little those little four-wheel drive forklifts with a rear wheel, that fifth wheel that they can bounce back on and spin around on. Beekeepers quickly learned how to use those to go out into a field and pick up a pallet with six beehives and then move it to a truck. And then they started to take them out to the fields with them.
So that really allowed beekeepers to have massive amounts of hives then, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you're picking them up by hand. And
that's what they were doing before then. They were picking up hives by hand, for a crew of four, five, six, whatever, how many people, picking up the hives, carrying them to the truck, two men carrying a hive, lifting it up on the truck, two more guys putting it into place, getting stung, bees flying everywhere, trying to put smoke into the air.
How often do they get stung?
Well, I mean, some of them wear protective equipment.
Sure.
But they can, get stung 20, 30, 40 times. They develop an immunity to it. When I was a bee inspector, I would get stung 4 or 5 or 10 times in a day sometimes. But you wear protective equipment.
Right.
If you're picking up the hives, they're getting squashed against you and they're stinging through fabric and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But with the forklifts, it's entirely different. They sit in the driver's seat with a veil and a hat and lift the hive up and carry it to the truck. And the bees are in the air at that time. They're not not necessarily stinging. They get
right.
Stings. But it changed it, dramatically. Being able to put the hives on the trucks and the hives are on forklifts so they could put a row of 120 or 240 or on up from there. And then they put nets over them. So they move them at night, put them on trucks, put nets over them, and then transport them during the day.
You talk about one beekeeper who brought 13,000 hives from Florida to South Dakota, and in 5 weeks made 1 million pounds of honey.
Yeah, Horace Bell. He was quite an amazing guy. One of the really fun things about writing this book was traveling around and meeting people like him. Andy Card introduced me to him, and Horace was known as the obsessive beekeeper, the mad driven beekeeper,
right,
who started off very young. And there's a certain type of beekeeper who, when he or maybe she gets into it, really wants to have lots of hives and to, go into it in a big way. There's
right.
a certain type of person who just thinks and thinks and thinks about that. And Horace Bell was kind of the quintessential obsessive beekeeper. And he built up. He had 13,000 hives that year that he was...
Well, 13,000?
13,000, yeah.
Okay,
I
folks...
I forget the number of truckloads. I think it was up into the 60s.
60 truckloads.
He hired... think of that. He hired semi-drivers and made 60 trips to North Dakota with his beehive.
Wow.
Found places to put them. You can't put them all in one place. You've got to spread it out.
Hold that thought. I'm going to pick it up when we get back. Folks,
okay.
This is the Food Chain, Michael Ogleson with Douglas Why Not, Following the Bloom. Right back. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain.
Hi, folks. How many of you out there love to garden? Wouldn't it be nice to grow some of your own food? Or maybe a flower garden would brighten your day. Well, now you can have the pleasures of gardening without all that effort. You don't need a tractor. You don't need a rototiller. All you need is the Knox Garden Box, a heavily constructed, portable, elevated garden on legs that can virtually change the way you've gardened in the past. The Knox Garden Box can be set up anywhere. Yes, you can place it right on concrete. For those with bad backs, you've got critters and gophers, no space or maybe no dirt. With the Knox Garden Box, the therapy of garden is now the prescription for good mental health. The way to find your fabulous Knox Garden Box is by logging on to KnoxGardenBox.com. That's K-N-O-X, GardenBox.com. Or by calling 831-461-9430.
Go. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about following the bloom with Douglas Wynot across America with migratory beekeepers. And we're talking about one Horace Bell who took 60 semi-loads of bees from Florida to South Dakota. What on earth were they looking for?
They were looking for honey crops on prairie clover, which grows in that region. And so the 13,000 hives that he took there were distributed over, you know, vast acreages.
Right.
They'd have to send someone up ahead of time, or he'd go himself and find locations. That's a big part of the work of a migratory beekeeper, finding location.
Oh, absolutely, because if you put your bees in the wrong place, yeah, nothing, right?
You get nothing, yeah. You have to put the right number in a place, too, so that you're, you know, maximizing the foraging, too, so they'd have to spread them out. But he eventually got up to 30,000 beehives, Horace did. But, yeah, 13,000 beehives, and he made 1 million pounds of honey that year. That was quite a crop.
Now, tell us about how they find the right place, you know, how they find the nectar flow. What is nectar flow, by the way?
It is a nectar flow. Yeah, there is a nectar flow. Well, Andy Card uses soil maps. You know, he'll find a region that, it depends where he's going, but, you know, I was out in western New York where he goes at the end of summer for a crop on goldenrod, which is that yellowish field plant we have out here that produces, you know, it's got this bright yellow color that produces a crop of honey, produces nectar. So he used soil maps that would have the best kind of soil for nectar flows, and he knows what that is. And then he would just drive around and look for spots that seem likely, and then stop and try to find the landowner and convince the landowner to let him put bees there. And that was usually with the offer of some honey,
right.
And sometimes quite a bit of it, you know, a case of 1 pound jars or several cases of 1 pound jars, and you know that was part of the arrangement, or you know maybe sometimes it would mean some money, but it was a matter of kind of networking and introducing yourself and looking for locations at first, and then of course those locations would be there available the next year, or most of them would be. So that's for him that was a constant effort at one time. Of finding locations. He did a lot of pollination work too. He's done more honey production lately, especially since his two sons have come into the business. But at first it was Florida in the winter, pollinating blueberries in New Jersey in April, pollinating apples in Massachusetts, New Hampshire,
so
and Maine.
So do they get paid for both things? I mean, if you're pollinating a crop, you get paid for pollinating, and you also make honey, right?
You get the honey, too, yeah. Now, there might not be a lot of honey on pollinating apple blossoms. There's some, but it's not like a big clover crop or something like
right.
that. His honey production is fairly low when he's pollinating. That's a very, you know, fast-paced, kind of stressful business. The bees come in during, you know, at the night. They're out on those trees. They're intensely placed. I mean, they tend to put a lot of bees in there to make sure that the
right.
crops are pollinated in that short 2 or 3 week period.
So you have a lot of bees competing for a little nectar.
Yeah. They saturate, oversaturate the area with bees. They try to. they get a fee for blueberries in New Jersey, and then it would be apples in New England, and then up to the main, what are called the blueberry barrens. These are vast acreages of just low bush blueberries, which are basically ground cover. And that's a big area, the biggest in New England for sure, maybe the biggest in the East, pollination. 10,000 acres of blueberries.
Wow.
With 10,000 hives or more. And their fees are way up there too. They're inducing. They have to have. You know, every one of those flowers, produces a blueberry if it's pollinated.
So these beekeepers, migratory beekeepers, are actually kind of like gypsies rolling across the land, right?
Kind of. Yeah, kind of like gypsies, but you know, they're not living in their trucks, but some of them are with their sometimes they live in their trucks. They're staying in motels. They're with their hives. Some of them are hired.
And during the season, it's pretty intense. I once tried to talk with a beekeeper who was pollinating almonds in California, and don't bother me.
Yeah, I've got work to do.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you know they're up all night, and they're working all day during. You know, they're moving the bees in at night, and they tend to be very stressed out during that time. Like you said before, the bees get their honey crop when the nectar flows, and so do the beekeepers.
So when the juices are flowing, the juices are flowing.
Yeah, they're intense, driven people, and they've been stung a lot of times too.
Right.
You know, but yeah, don't bother me during that time of year. Of course, when I did it, I was there and part of it, and kept in touch, and I'd been with them, traveling with them in their trucks, and you know, moving around with them. So I was able to follow the bloom along with them.
So what is the most intense part of the work cycle then when you're on the road?
It's moving the bees. Yeah, moving the bees, especially during the daytime. If you you're a little late arriving. Like one time I was with Andy Card, and we loaded the bees up around dusk.
Right.
One day around dusk, we loaded the bees up, 440 hives on a semi, and then drove up to the blueberry barrens in Maine. It was a long trip. That's way up in the furthermost eastern part of Maine. And by the time we got there and unloaded the hives, it was daylight.
Wow.
And those bees were flying. They were everywhere.
We're going to have to take a quick break. Right back, folks. Okay. This is the Food Chain.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're following the bloom with Douglas Wynot, Across America with Migratory Beekeepers. A great story. Pick it up. Enjoy it. Learn a little bit about the bees that make one in three of your mouthfuls of food possible. We're talking about the big move from the south all the way up to the north, and you have to have them someplace by dawn, right?
You have to have them in place by dawn, usually. I mean, that's the ideal thing is to load the bees up, move them, and unload them before light comes, because as soon as light comes, they're out of the hives. They're ready to fly. They even will come out of the hives while they're transporting them. That's why they put nets over them.
Right.
Sometimes if things aren't done correctly, the bees will come out, and they'll be all over the nets. You'll see, you know, solid wall of bees on the nets. But you have to get them. You should get them there before they start doing that. But if you're traveling from Florida to North Dakota, say, you're traveling during the daytime a couple of times.
Right.
So they are, you know, they're exposed to the daylight, and that, you know, that can
so that's
be a mess. But
that's just the way of it. Then you just got to do it anyway. Get them up there.
Yeah.
Let's look at the future of beekeeping here in the United States. You talk about the tremendous need, even for almond crops, where you have one crop that's sucking up, you know, the equivalent for the entire bee population in the country. That what does that do with everybody else then?
Well, there's a really potentially devastating problem, and there was a, you know, it had come to the fore this past year because of a new problem,
right.
A pathogen that they think is a virus, but there have been, you know, problems developing for the last 20 years. The first big one was the tracheal mite. There have always been diseases, bee diseases, that you know, we've treated and protected beekeepers against. American foul brood was the big one,
right?
And then the tracheal mites came along in '85, and then the varroa mites came a few later, a different kind of pest.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, there's been something called the disappearing disease that they think is a virus that has wiped out the entire colony count of some beekeepers.
Right.
Just wiped them completely out. It hasn't happened to all the beekeepers. It hasn't happened to Andy Card. He's not too worried about it. He says
it's
something that hits in some places. But Andy Card manages his hives to lose 20% per year. He has 15,000 beehives. So, you know, figure that out. That's 3,000 beehives per year. But he's constantly regenerating from his stock.
Sure.
But when this is putting a stress on the bee population in this country, and there's a big concern about this. I mean, there was a lot of media attention, as you know.
Right.
This past year.
What happened to the bees? Yeah,
because
they just disappeared.
What's happening? Right. And we know that if we lose the bees, well, we lose, as you say, a third of our food source. We lose apples. We lose almonds. We lose an important food
For dairy.
For dairy. We lose melons. You know, we lose cherries. On and on it goes. We're in big trouble. So, with the inability of hobbyist beekeepers to keep bees, we are more and more indebted to the commercial beekeeper.
And more and more vulnerable,
yeah. So this is something that definitely needs attention and support, I would say.
Well, Douglas Wynott, we thank you so much for joining us today. The book is Following the Bloom, Across America with Migratory Beekeepers. What a fun read. Thank you so much for joining us. Now,
are you
pessimistic?
No, I'm not. I mean, I don't know how many beehive can be, how big the almond industry can get, but
we'll see.
I think
it. We're out of time, so
okay.
I have to go. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.